Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We have an absolutely massive stack of documents today, and I mean that literally and figuratively.
It's a big one.
It is. We are looking at a topic that is, on the surface, about civil engineering. But when you really peel back the layers, it's about survival. It's about the sheer audacity of humans looking at the ocean and saying, no. You stop here.
It really is a story about the ultimate boundary. We are talking about the Delta Works in the Netherlands.
The Delta Works.
Right. And to just call it a project feels like it's a disservice. This is more like a planetary modification.
Well, I was reading through the intro material, and the accolade that really jumped out at me wasn't from a Dutch organization.
Oh.
It was from the American Society of Civil Engineers. They declared this one of the seven wonders of the modern world.
That is no small praise. I mean, that puts it in the league of the Panama Canal, the Golden Gate Bridge.
The Empire State Building. Exactly. But here's the thing that struck me while reading. When you think of the Golden Gate Bridge, you think about connection, right? Getting from A to B, the Panama Canal, you think about commerce, cutting travel time. But the Delta Works, this feels existential.
That is the perfect word for it. It's totally existential. The Netherlands is a geological oddity. Hmm. It's the river delta for three massive European rivers, the Rhine, the Meuse, and the Scheldt. And a huge percentage of the land is below sea level.
A huge percentage.
Without these works, the country as we know it simply wouldn't exist. It would be a swamp or, you know, just the bottom of the North Sea.
So the mission statement in the source material, it's phrased in this very dry, bureaucratic way. But when you visualize it, it's wild. The goal was shortening the coastline.
It sounds so abstract, doesn't it?
It sounds like a supervillain plot. I shall shorten the coastline. But in this context, it's the primary defense strategy. Can you maybe walk us through the geometry of that? Why does shortening the line save the country?
It's all about efficiency and exposure. So imagine the southwest of the Netherlands before these works began. It wasn't a solid block of land like we might see on a simplified map today.
Not at all.
It was a jagged, fractured collection of islands, deep estuaries, winding inlets. The sea didn't just touch the edge, it reached deep inland, wrapping around all these little islands.
Like the frayed edge of a piece of denim.
That's a perfect analogy, and every single inch of that frayed edge had to be defended. We are talking about hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of old earthen dikes.
That all needed constant monitoring, maintenance.
Constant repair. If you have 700 kilometers of coastline, you have 700 kilometers of potential failure points.
So the logic is just less coast, less danger.
Precisely. The shortening concept is brutal efficiency. If you look at the map, you see these wide mouths where the estuaries open to the sea.
Right.
If you block those mouths, if you connect the islands at their outer edge, you effectively draw a straight line across the coast. Yeah. You seal the bathtub.
And by doing that, you cut the coastline that needs defending
by roughly 700 kilometers.
Well, you trade hundreds of kilometers of winding, vulnerable, old-fashioned dikes for just a few kilometers of massive, high-tech, fortified dams.
That is the trade-off. You put all your eggs in a few very, very strong baskets.
But this wasn't just a case of engineers getting bored and looking for a cool project. The sources make it crystal clear that there was a catalyst,
mm-hmm.
a specific dark moment in history that forced all this to happen.
The North Sea Flood of 1953.
The details in the reading were just harrowing.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people hear flood in a modern context, they think of a wet basement or maybe a river overbanking and ruining some carpet. This was
a whole different ballgame, a catastrophe on a national scale. It was the perfect storm. Quite literally, you had a high spring tide combined with a severe windstorm over the North Sea.
Just pushing all that water right into the funnel of the English Channel.
Exactly, and straight at the Dutch coast. The water rose rapidly in the middle of the night.
And the dikes weren't ready.
The dikes were in terrible condition. You have to remember the context. This is 1953.
Yep.
The country was still recovering from World War II. During the war, maintenance had been, it was completely neglected. And you had the economic depression in the 30s before that.
So the authorities knew, right? The reports were there.
Oh, they knew. There were reports sitting on desks saying the dikes were insufficient, but indecision and the war just paralyzed them.
That's the part that's so frustrating. The knowledge was there. The engineering reports were there. But they couldn't get the political will to act until after the disaster happened.
It's a tragic recurring theme in infrastructure, isn't it?
It is.
Proactive prevention is politically difficult to sell. It costs money and nobody sees the benefit because, nothing happens. That is the benefit. Reactive reconstruction is politically mandatory.
So the flood hits. Over 1,800 people lose their lives. thousands of homes destroyed, livestock just wiped out.
Yeah.
And the mindset shifts overnight.
It shifted from, we should probably fix this eventually, to never again. That became the national mantra. The Delta Works Commission was formed almost immediately.
And their job wasn't just to patch the holes.
No, it was to rethink the entire relationship between the land and the sea.
And this brings us to the first major section of our deep dive, the mathematics of safety. Because I expected this to be a story about concrete and steel, but the Delta Commission started with philosophy and statistics.
They did. They realized that the old way of thinking, just looking at history, was a trap. Before this, they would look at the highest flood level ever recorded, maybe add a few centimeters for a safety margin, and build the wall to that height.
Which works right up until a storm comes along that's bigger than any you remember.
Exactly. History is not a predictor of the future, especially with weather. The commission needed a conceptual framework that looked forward.
So they turned to probability.
They turned to probability. And they introduced this concept of the Delta norm.
I spent some time looking at the maps and the notes about these dike rings. It's such a fascinating way to organize a country. Can you unpack that a bit?
Yeah, so think of the Netherlands not as one single landmass, but as a series of separate watertight compartments. In the documents, these are called dike ring areas. Uh-huh.
And each compartment is an area surrounded by a continuous line of primary sea defenses.
It almost reminds me of the bulkheads on a ship. You know, if one compartment breaches, the water is contained there and the rest of the ship stays afloat.
That is a very, very accurate analogy. But unlike a ship, these compartments are where millions of people live and work and sleep.
Right.
So the commission identified the major areas that needed protection. And then, and this is the part of governance that is incredibly difficult, they had to decide how much protection each ring deserved.
Deserved is such a heavy word when you're talking about human safety.
It is, but it's the cold logic of econometrics. You cannot build walls to the moon. It's physically impossible and economically ruinous.
So you have to define acceptable risk.
You have to. And to do that, they performed a cost-benefit analysis. On one side of the equation is the cost of building and maintaining the dams. On the other side is the cost of a flood. And calculating the cost of a flood, I mean, it seems straightforward for things like buildings or cows. You could look up the market price. But the sources mentioned they included the loss of human life in the equation.
They did. And this is where it gets uncomfortable.
Yeah, I paused when I read that section. It feels taboo, almost immoral, to put a price tag on a human being. But the model needed a number to function. The source we have mentions data from 2008, where a human life was valued at 2.2 million.
It sounds callous, I know. You were worth 2.2 million euros. But in public policy, if you don't have that number, you can't justify the investment.
Also,
if the loss of life is considered incalculable or infinite, then the budget to prevent it becomes undefined and nothing gets built. By quantifying the value of a life, however grim that feels, you can mathematically prove to the government that spending $5 billion on a dam is a bargain compared to the statistical cost of the lives it saves.
So they ran these numbers, they cranked the handle on the calculator, and they came up with the Delta norm. And I was surprised to see that the safety standards aren't uniform across the country.
No.
Not every Dutch citizen gets the same level of protection.
No, they don't. And that is based on population density and economic impact. The highest standard is applied to the Randstad, the economic heart of the country in South Holland. That includes cities like Rotterdam, The Hague, Delft.
And the source says the acceptable risk there is 1 in 10,000 years.
Let's really look at that number. 1 in 10,000.
It's huge.
It is. Now, that doesn't mean a flood happens once every 10,000 years like a comet coming back. It means that in any given year, this year, next year, the year after, there is a 0.01% chance of the defenses failing.
That is an incredibly high standard. I was trying to find a comparison. I think the standard for dike safety in places like New Orleans before Katrina was, what, 1 in 100? Significantly lower.
Much, much lower. The Dutch standard is arguably the most rigorous in the world. And there's a specific reason for that mentioned in the technical notes. It isn't just because there are a lot of people there.
It's about warning time.
It's about warning time? Exactly. If you're dealing with a river flood, say the Mississippi or the Rhine further upstream, you can see the water rising days in advance.
You can pack your car, you can evacuate.
You have time. But a storm surge from the North Sea can develop in a matter of hours.
You cannot evacuate 4 million people from the Randstad overnight.
It is impossible. There is nowhere to go, and the roads would gridlock instantly. If the dikes fail in South Holland, the result is mass casualties. It would be the end of the nation as a functioning state. So the walls must be practically invincible.
But then you look at other areas, and the risk is set at 1 in 4,000 years. Still very safe, but, you know, not quite as safe.
Right. And for river flooding, it's even lower, 1 in 12,250 years.
And that river flooding distinction is interesting. The source material points out a crucial difference, salinity.
Yes. River water is fresh water.
Why does the salt content matter for the safety standard? I mean, water is water when it's in your living room.
True, but for the recovery of the nation, it matters immensely. If you flood a farm with fresh water, it dries out, and maybe you lose a season of crops, but next year you can plant again.
Okay.
If you flood that same farm with North Sea salt water, you have salted the earth. The soil chemistry is destroyed. Nothing grows there for years, perhaps decades.
So the economic damage is exponentially higher.
Exactly. And so the protection against it must be higher.
So the Delta Works aren't just a physical barrier. They're a manifestation of a statistical model, a calculated gamble where the odds are heavily stacked in our favor, but it's still a gamble.
Engineering is always a gamble against nature. The Dutch just calculated the odds better than anyone else.
And decided 0.01% was the only number they could sleep with at night.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so they have the math. They have the Delta norm. They have the budget. Now they have to actually build the things. And this is where the story shifts from a spreadsheet to a construction site. And the engineering evolution here is wild.
It really is. Because the plan, the original plan did not survive contact with reality.
The first idea in the 1950s seemed pretty blunt. It was the closed coast policy. Just close the holes.
Right. The engineers looked at the map and said, we have these big estuaries, the Oosterschelde, the Graveling Inn, and so on. Let's just build solid dams across the mouths.
From a purely hydraulic perspective, that makes sense. A solid dam is the strongest dam. No moving parts, just a mountain of sand and concrete.
It is. And for several of the smaller inlets, that's exactly what they did. They created freshwater lakes behind the dams. But when they got to the Oosterschelde, the Eastern Schelde, the plan hit a wall.
And the wall wasn't water.
The wall was people.
The source details a major conflict here. By the late 60s and early 70s, the world was changing. The environmental movement was starting to wake up.
And the Oosterschelde wasn't just a threat, it was a treasure. It was this unique tidal ecosystem teeming with life. Shellfish, lobsters, seals, unique birds.
And it was a home of the Dutch oyster and mussel industry.
Critically, yes.
I can imagine the fishermen weren't exactly thrilled about the idea of turning their tidal farm into a stagnant freshwater lake.
They were furious. And they were joined by environmentalists and scientists who argued that you can't just destroy a unique marine environment in the name of safety. There had to be another way.
This feels like a pivotal moment. Usually in these massive state projects, the steamroller just keeps moving. Sorry about your oysters, but we're building a dam.
Mm-hmm.
But here, the government actually blinked.
They didn't just blink, they pivoted. Parliament intervened. They amended the plan and demanded a solution that provided the safety of the Delta Norm but preserved the tidal environment.
Which sounds impossible. Keep the water out, but also let the water in.
It was a total engineering paradox. Build me a wall that isn't a wall. And the solution they came up with is the Oosterschelde ring, the storm surge barrier.
The description of this thing is just mind-boggling. The sources call it a semi-permeable dam.
So imagine a series of colossal concrete pillars, some the size of cathedrals, dropped into the mouth of the estuary. The scale is just hard to convey. These pillars are 30, 40 meters high.
Wow.
And between these pillars, they hung massive steel sliding gates.
So they're like valves,
yeah.
Giant valves.
Exactly. Under normal conditions, which is 99% of the time, the gates are lifted up high above the water.
So the tide flows in and out.
The tide flows in, the tide flows out, the oysters are happy, the water remains salty, the seals can swim through, the ecosystem is preserved.
But when the weather turns.
When a storm approaches and the water level is predicted to rise 3 meters above the mean, the buttons are pushed.
And the gates drop.
Massive hydraulic cylinders push these steel walls down, and in roughly an hour, the open estuary becomes a solid dam. The North Sea is locked out.
That is incredibly cool. It's active defense. It's not a passive wall. It's a machine.
A very, very expensive machine. The source notes that this change in plan from a solid dam to a storm surge barrier doubled or tripled the cost of that section and extended the timeline by years.
But it proved that safety and ecology could technically coexist if you have enough money and ingenuity.
If you have enough money, yes. Because remember, by not closing the estuary permanently, they created another problem. Since the tide still comes in every day, the dikes behind the barrier further inland were still exposed to the daily tidal water. So they had to strengthen hundreds of kilometers of those inner dikes anyway.
Was that a shortcut?
Not at all. It was a scenic, expensive, technically difficult route, but it saved the ecosystem.
There's another example of this engineering colliding with reality in the notes, the Rotterdam Challenge. This one seems even more complex because you're dealing with a major city.
The Maaslandkering. This is perhaps even more visually striking than the Oosterscheld barrier.
The problem here was the Nieuwe Waterweg, the shipping channel.
Yes. Rotterdam is one of the biggest ports in the world. It is the gateway to Europe. You cannot dam the entrance to the port. You'd kill the economy immediately. Ships need to come and go 24/7.
But you still have to protect the millions of people living behind it.
Correct. So the traditional solution would be to heighten the dikes along the river running through the city. Just make the walls taller.
But the source says that would have required demolishing historic parts of Rotterdam and other towns.
Imagine telling a city like Rotterdam, which was already flattened in World War II, that you need to bulldoze their historic center again to build a higher wall. It was socially unacceptable. The public pressure was immense.
So once again, they had to invent a new solution. They couldn't build up because of the buildings, and they couldn't build across because of the ships.
So they built arms.
The Maaslandkering, looking at the diagram here, it looks like two curved floating gates resting in docks on either side of the river.
Think of two massive Eiffel Towers laid on their sides, curved to fit the river. They're just resting in dry docks on the banks. The river stays wide open for ships.
Okay.
But when the storm comes, they flood the docks, the gates float, and they swing out into the river like a pair of embracing arms.
And they meet in the middle?
They meet in the middle, they lock together, and then, this is the genius part, they flood the hollow chambers inside the gates themselves with water.
Ah, so they become heavy.
They become incredibly heavy and sink to the bottom, anchoring themselves into the riverbed.
A sunken steel wall.
It is the largest moving object on Earth, by some definitions. Specifically, the ball and socket joints that allow the gates to pivot. They're the largest ball joints in the world. Each one is 10 meters in diameter.
A ball joint the size of a house.
A ball joint made of high-grade steel that has to be smooth enough to rotate, but strong enough to hold back the entire North Sea pushing against the arm. The engineering precision is just staggering.
And it was completed in 1997. The sources say that this marked the end of the Delta Works.
Technically, yes. The Maaslandkering was the final piece of the original puzzle. The Queen presided over the opening. It was mission accomplished.
But mission accomplished is always a dangerous phrase, isn't it?
Always.
Because as we look at the later documents, it becomes clear that finished is a very relative term.
Absolutely. Finished just means the concrete is dry. It doesn't mean the problem is gone. And before we talk about the future, we have to look at the hangover of the past. We talked about how the Oosterscheld was saved, but the sources are very honest that not everything went that smoothly.
Right. The projects designed in the 1950s and 60s, the solid dams we mentioned earlier, the source explicitly states that ecological effects were barely taken into consideration back then.
It was a different era. Nature was something to be conquered, not consulted. When you block those other estuaries, you stop the tide. You take a dynamic, flowing marine environment and turn it into a stagnant freshwater bucket.
The text mentions the transition is abrupt.
It's catastrophic for the existing life. The salt-loving plants die immediately. The fish that need to migrate are blocked. The birds that feed on the tidal flats lose their food source because the flats no longer dry out.
And there was a water quality issue too, wasn't there?
A big one. Rivers carry sediment and, unfortunately, pollution. In an open system, the tide flushes that out to sea. In a closed system, it settles at the bottom.
So you get this buildup of polluted sludge.
You get sludge. The water can become toxic with algae blooms. It can turn into a dead zone.
So they solved the quantity problem, keeping the ocean out.
Yeah.
But created a quality problem.
Exactly. And facing that reality led to a major paradigm shift. If you look at the documents from post-2008, the philosophy is completely different.
They call it building with nature.
It sounds like a marketing slogan, I know, but it's a profound change in engineering strategy.
How does it differ from the old concrete wall approach?
The old approach is static defense. Build a line, hold the line. Concrete, steel, asphalt. Building with nature is dynamic defense. It recognizes that nature is a force you can actually leverage.
The example that really stood out to me was Room for the River.
This is a fascinating program. For centuries, the Dutch strategy for rivers was to squeeze them between higher and higher dikes to maximize farmland. The river became a narrow, fast-moving chute.
Which means if it overflows, the water is moving fast and high, like putting your thumb over a hose.
Right. Room for the River reverses that. They are actually moving dikes back, widening the riverbeds, lowering the floodplains.
They're giving land back to the water. That seems so counterintuitive for a country that is famous for creating land.
It's a radical shift. They are taking agricultural land and turning it into spillways or nature parks.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is, when the river floods, let it flood the park. It slows the water down, lowers the water level, and doesn't destroy anyone's home.
It's almost like a pressure relief valve, but made of land.
Precisely. It creates a buffer zone. It allows the water to be there without being a disaster. It's conceding space to gain safety.
There was another example called sand nourishment or the sand motor.
This is just brilliant in its simplicity. The coast is always eroding. The sea eats the sand. The old way to fix it was to put down concrete blocks or plant heavy grass to lock the dunes in place.
Or make the dunes rigid.
But rigid things break, and they stop the natural cycle of sand replenishment. So now with the sand motor, they dredge up millions of cubic meters of sand from the deep sea and dump it in a massive peninsula off the coast.
A strategic sand pile.
And then they do nothing. They just walk away. They let the wind and the currents distribute that sand along the coast over the next 20 years.
So the forces of nature do the construction work for you.
Exactly. It keeps the dunes healthy and growing, which makes them a better, more resilient barrier than any concrete wall could be.
It feels like a real maturity in engineering. Like, okay, we built the giant robot, but maybe we should also learn to dance.
That's a poetic way to put it. It's recognizing that the ecosystem is a layer of defense, not just an obstacle to be paved over.
I do want to pivot to the financials, because wonder of the modern world doesn't come cheap. And the numbers here are staggering, even before you adjust for inflation.
It's a classic case of project creep, both in scope and in cost. In 1958, the original estimate was 3.3 billion guilders.
Which, for a small country just recovering from a war, is an enormous amount of money.
It was 20% of the national GDP at the time. Imagine the United States today deciding to build a project that cost $4 or $5 trillion. That's the level of national commitment we're talking about.
And that was just the estimate.
By the time it was finished in 1997, the cost was 8.2 billion guilders. A 2012 estimate put the total investment at around $13 billion.
Where did all that money come from? I saw a mention of the Marshall Plan.
The post-war U.S. aid was significant. About 400 million guilders helped to kickstart the recovery that made this possible. But there's a twist in the funding story that I find fascinating.
Oh.
A crucial funding source came from the ground itself.
The Groningen gas field.
Exactly. In the late 50s and early 60s, the Netherlands discovered a massive natural gas bubble in the north. The revenue from that gas, that Aardgasbaten, was an incredible windfall for the state.
There's a bit of irony there, isn't there?
A massive irony.
Using fossil fuels to pay for the defense against rising seas, which are caused by...
Fossil fuels. It's a complex feedback loop, certainly. We're using the proceeds of carbon extraction to defend against the consequences of carbon emissions. But without that gas revenue, it's hard to say if the project could have been executed at this scale and quality. The gas paid for the dams.
So we have the barriers, we have the new philosophy, we have the bill paid,
mm-hmm.
but the source material ends on a note that is anything but happily ever after.
No, the story doesn't end. It just enters a more frightening chapter. The source material discusses the Delta Commission of 2008, the second commission.
Right. This was the report looking not at the next 10 years, but at the next two centuries.
And the numbers in that report are alarming. They highlighted that the original Delta Works were built for the climate of the 20th century. But the climate of the 21st and 22nd centuries is a different beast.
We're talking about sea level rise.
The report advises the government to plan for a rise in the North Sea of 1.3 meters by the year 2100. And looking further out, to the year 2200, they modeled a rise of 4 meters.
4 meters. That's over 12 feet.
12 feet of vertical rise. That essentially negates the current dikes. If the sea rises 4 meters, the current Maeslankring, the Oosterscheld barrier, they'd be overwhelmed. They'd just be speed bumps.
The report mentions a proposed spending of over $100 billion through the year 2100 just to keep up.
It's an unending mortgage. You have to keep paying just to stay in the house.
But there was one detail in that report that really gave me chills. It mentioned that they're even drawing up worst-case scenarios for evacuation.
That stopped me in my tracks, too.
We are talking about one of the most advanced nations on Earth, with the best water engineers in history, having a serious meeting about what if we lose.
It highlights the limits of engineering. The Delta Works are a triumph of human ingenuity, but they are not magic. They're physical barriers in a changing world. And even the Dutch are realizing that there might be a limit to how high you can build the wall.
What if we have to leave? That is such an existential thought for a nation.
It really reframes the whole story. We start by talking about this static wonder of the world, this Finnish monument, but it's actually a living, breathing struggle, a war that doesn't end.
It makes that delta norm, that 1 in 10,000 number, feel less like a guarantee and more like a temporary truce.
The delta norm taught us that safety isn't a binary state, safe or unsafe. It's a statistic. And as the sea level rises, the denominator in that fraction gets smaller. Your 1 in 10,000 risk becomes 1 in 1,000, then 1 in 100. Unless you keep building higher.
It really makes you wonder. The Netherlands is basically the laboratory for the rest of the world.
In many ways, yes. As sea levels rise globally, coastal cities everywhere, New York, Jakarta, Shanghai, Miami, are looking at the Dutch model. They're hiring Dutch engineers.
Well, that leads to the big question, the one that the source material leaves hanging in the air. We see the billions spent, the decades of work, the constant need for upgrades. Is this sustainable?
That is the question. Is the Dutch model of fortress engineering really the blueprint for the future, or is it a warning?
A warning that you can buy safety, but the price just keeps going up.
And that eventually, the physics might just outweigh the economics. Eventually, the water always wins.
It's a sobering thought to end on, but a really important one. The Delta works are a miracle, but even miracles need maintenance.
And adaptation.
And a lot of sand.
And a lot of sand.
Well, that wraps up our deep dive into the Delta Works. From the 1 in 10,000 year risks to the massive robot arms of Rotterdam, there is a lot to chew on.
Indeed.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next deep dive.